This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight,
we've moved into a new phase of protest, resistance and repression, which is much more violent and with players who are much more risk-averse.
That's Pierre Pigou, the International Crisis Group Senior Consultant for Southern Africa, talking about the protests in Zimbabwe. Details coming up also. Nigeria's election body has announced 80.4 million Nigerians are registered to vote next month. And also, veteran musician Oliver Mtuguzi has died. He passed away in Harare today. He was 66. We'll have these stories and more on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, observers of Zimbabwe are expressing pessimism about the future of the Southern African country following the violence there, which has left at least 12 people dead and hundreds injured. State soldiers and police cracked down on protests against a huge petrol price increase, with cash-strapped Zimbabweans now expected to pay more than $3 for a liter of fuel, the highest price in the world. Two Southern African authorities on Zimbabwe say the latest unrest is just the beginning of a new wave of upheaval in the country. Darren Taylor reports from Johannesburg.
The International Crisis Group's senior consultant for Southern Africa, Piers Pigou, is not surprised by the latest violence in Zimbabwe. He says new policies introduced by the government of President Emmerson Mnangagwa have worsened the country's currency crisis, rapidly deteriorating citizens' purchasing power. Pigou says a Zimbabwean who once had $100 in the bank now has just $30.
It's ripped the guts out of most ordinary Zimbabweans' wealth, and we've seen the knock-on effects of that in terms of shortages, most prevalent in relation to fuel, but also in a number of other commodities, and a massive increase in the prices of basic foodstuffs as well.
Pigou recounts experiences shared by contacts in Zimbabwe, like one family in the capital, Harare.
Someone tried to sell them a mango for $15. We've seen some of the costs that are being put out there, which are astronomical. $12 for four avocados was another one that was...
He says even Zimbabweans with jobs and stable incomes are becoming desperate, such as civil servants who now demand to be paid in US dollars.
But the government simply can't afford this because it is bankrupt and is now reaping the rewards of a financial delinquency that played out in the Mugabe administration, but also, we should point out, with the Mnangagwa administration last year as well.
Mnangagwa replaced President Robert Mugabe when the military forced him out of office in late 2017. The leader of the Zimbabwe project at the South African Institute of International Affairs, Aditi Lalbahadur, says Zimbabweans are angry and disappointed. She says the misery they experienced under Mugabe is continuing, despite Mnangagwa's promise to improve their lives. Lalbahadur says the Mnangagwa administration has not introduced the political and social reforms needed to attract the investment that would boost the economy.
The failure to address the long-standing political problems means that the economic problems will perpetuate and even exacerbate, and that's exactly what we're seeing.
Pigou says Mnangagwa initially presented what he calls an interesting set of reforms and reform commitments.
Cynicism has been growing amongst a number of constituencies that were previously prepared to give the administration the benefit of the doubt, increasingly concerned that they're not able to walk their talk.
Lalbahadur says the government doesn't appear committed to transparent financial management of its business and to rooting out high-level corruption. On the human rights front, Pigou says initially the number and intensity of violations in Zimbabwe dropped, but then came the post-election violence at the beginning of August. Government soldiers and police join forces with supporters of the ruling ZANU-PF party to hunt down and assault protesters. 6 people were killed, with hundreds injured. A similar pattern has emerged during the fuel price riots. Pigou says state actors and their allies continue to have impunity for abuses, and there are reports of security forces using live ammunition for crowd control purposes.
We've moved into a new phase of protest resistance and repression, which is much more violent and with players who are much more risk averse.
Lal Bahadur says the latest upheaval has exposed the Mnangagwa administration as operating within the same system as Mugabe, still propped up by the military and the police. Just as it did under Mugabe, ZANU-PF blames the latest violence on the opposition Movement for Democratic Change. Pigou says this ignores the fact that Zimbabweans of all political persuasions are protesting. This, he says, is evidence of a much more fractured and polarized Zimbabwe. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Johannesburg.
Protests continue in Khartoum and other major cities in Sudan, calling for President Omar al-Bashir to leave office after 3 decades. The government has responded with tear gas, shooting at protesters and arresting hundreds of them. Bashir has said the only way to change the government is to wait for the next elections. Joseph Siegel, Director of Research at Africa Center for Strategic Studies, discussed with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi whether Sudan is witnessing another Arab Spring type of uprising and what different scenarios could emerge from the protests in the country.
I think we're still some ways before an Arab Spring, but clearly we're seeing unprecedented levels of protest and pressure on al-Bashir right now. And the protests that we're seeing are a result of some very fundamental flaws within the economy and within the governance structures within Sudan, which are going to be hard for him to resolve. So I think he is in a very difficult position. Whether or not we're going to see a change, I think, remains to be seen.
But so far, the Sudanese government response was limited to using tear gas, shooting at protesters and arresting hundreds of them. And the president said the only way to change the government is to wait for elections. What do you make of that?
Well, I think it is notable that they're showing some degree of restraint in the past. The security forces and other government-aligned militias have not held back in using violence and resulting in hundreds of deaths and such protest. So I think it reflects that the government feels it's in a weaker position. And it is also trying to negotiate more debt relief and aid from external partners. And it knows it's not going to receive that if it is seen as too repressive in dealing with these protests.
There is a common problem in Africa, which is presidents are not leaving office when it's time to do so. But in the Sudanese case, the constitution does not contain 2-term limit. Would that justify al-Bashir 3-decade rule?
Yes, we're talking about a leader here who's been in power for 30 years and is seen widely as being a big part of the problem, both economically, politically, and from a security standpoint. Interestingly, at this point, al-Bashir is supposed to step down in 2020 when his term ends. However, his party is trying to amend the Constitution so that the limit is lifted, allowing him to continue indefinitely. And I think that's part of what's causing these protests to boil over. People just don't see any other end in sight, no other resolution to the current misery that they're facing. And so I think he is very much the focus of a lot of these protests.
Then what's the way out of the Sudanese current crisis?
I think there's several possible scenarios. One, you know, he may try to resort to heavy-handed repression, but I think that could very likely backfire and leading to even more protest, and it would certainly alienate him more with the international partners that he needs to bail him out of the economic crisis they're facing. Secondly, we could see some sort of military takeover or some other rival within his party try to seize power. I think that is also problematic in that there's not one clear-cut rival who could rally the support of the security forces and would have popular support to do that. Moreover, they would continue to face the same fundamental challenges that have been building up for decades in Sudan. And third, Bashir could try to negotiate his own exit and agree that he would step down, perhaps with some conditions for immunity or some sort of protection, but working with technocratic leaders, maybe some representatives from opposition and civil society, to manage a transition in a way that would be more well-received among the general public, but would also signal to the international community that there is a real economic strategy in place that would enable the economy to stabilize and would create better prospects for investment and really trying to create longer-term commitments in Sudan.
That was Joseph Siegel, Director of Research at Africa Center for Strategic Studies. He spoke to my colleague, Mohammed El-Shenawi. Also in Sudan news, Reuters reports today that Sudanese oil minister Azhari Abdel Kadir said the government has received assistance from the United Arab Emirates. Kadir also said Turkey and Russia are offering assistance to the economically troubled country. Seventeen past the hour, you were listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. The UN Refugee Agency says thousands of Nigerian refugees are fleeing to Chad to escape a surge of violence in northeastern Nigeria's Borno state. Lisa Schlein reports from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
Fierce clashes between government forces and armed militants from the radical Islamic group Boko Haram erupted in late December in Borno State's Baga town near the Chadian border. The UN Refugee Agency reports an estimated 6,000 Nigerian refugees have fled for their lives over the past month, many paddling across Lake Chad to reach safety. The UNHCR says most of the new arrivals are women and children. Many describe their desperation to escape the violence after receiving threats of retaliation and intimidation following militant attacks. UNHCR spokesman Charlie Yaxley says Chadian authorities have asked his agency to move the refugees away from the border area because of security concerns. He tells VOA UNHCR staff so far has moved some 4,200 refugees to an existing camp some 45 kilometers away.
At the moment, we don't have any indications that the fighting has spilled out across the border, but as I mentioned, the fighting in Borno State remains extremely volatile, and as a precautionary measure, it was decided to bring them further inland in order to provide them with their needs and assure their safety.
Yaxley says the UNHCR is racing against time to provide shelter and other aid to those arriving. He says new arrivals are staying in shelters where they are receiving relief items, including blankets, mats, and mosquito nets, as well as hot meals. Last week, the government of Cameroon forcibly deported some 9,000 Nigerian refugees who had fled fighting in Borno State. Yaxley says the UNHCR is following up on their fate. He acknowledges, however, it is difficult to get good information about their whereabouts and condition since insecurity restricts access to the area. Boko Haram seeks to destroy Nigeria's secular state and establish an Islamic state under Sharia. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Nigeria's election body, the Independent National Electoral Commission, has announced the total number of registered voters for the 2019 elections. The commission says 80.4 million Nigerians registered to vote next month. Students, farmers, and housewives had the highest number of registered voters. Dr. Uche Ibizi is the head of the Department of Mass Communications at Namindi Azikiwe University at Oko. Ibizi spoke to reporter Mike Mbonye about the number of voters for the election. He says many students may not cast their ballots when Nigerians vote for president on February 16th because of the ongoing strike by university lecturers.
Let us start by saying the 80 million registered voters are not the 80 million that are going to vote. That's one. Because registration is different from participation. But this time around, as you can see, students normally vote here. They normally vote. But the problem is, this time around, are they around to vote? Because they registered when they were in school. So what we are praying for now, if they actually want students to participate in this election, they should call off the strike. Let them come back. You don't expect a student who's in Lagos to travel all the way from Lagos to come down here where he registered to vote. It's not possible. But this time around, I don't think students are going to participate as adequately as possible as they did last time. That's the problem. They're not here to take part. They registered when they were in school and they can't come back. So students' votes are off the election this time around, and it's a terrible blow. Which means students are not going to be represented in this election, period. Unless those that traveled home during that period to register. If not, they can't participate.
How are the farmers and fishers likely to vote? What is the top issue for them?
Well, I think from what I've heard from the media, the farmers have an inkling to the present administration because they believe the administration actually is favoring them in terms of farming, trying to provide them with fertilizers, farming equipment, and all whatnot. I think they are going to vote. They are going to participate. I don't know which direction their votes are going to really go, but I believe they are going to participate because their interest is at stake here, and they believe that the government of the day has their interest at heart, and the whole economy. Farmers, fishers, or fishermen, what are you doing without food? And they prefer a government that will actually take their interest at heart. And they believe, well, that this government is actually... Look at what happened last time. Said they gave farmers many bags and millions of fertilizers, and this Miati, whatever, farmers and all whatnot. I think they are going to participate. They are going to fully participate.
What issues would dominate for the housewives?
This is a very critical question. Well, every housewife actually prays for the economic growth of the husband. First of all, the housewives are going to think of what the husbands are doing, whether the manifestos, the promises are going to really favor their husbands. Let me tell you something. African women most times don't even think of themselves. They think of their family, their husbands. So whatever will affect their husbands or affect their husbands' pockets positively is going to equally affect them. So I think the issue that will now dominate the housewives, whatever, is that of economy, trying to improve their husband's pocket and also improve their economic life. And what are those things? Money, incremental salary, minimum wage, and all whatnot. I think those are the issues they want to hear. They don't want to hear about other things. Religion is what will really actually improve on their economic lives and social lives. So which government is doing that, we don't know yet. But that's the issue exactly that will dominate housewives' views this time around. That's why I say it.
That was Uche Ibizi, head of the Department of Mass Communication at the Namdi Ezekwe University. He spoke with reporter Mike Mbonye in Oko. Veteran musician Oliver Mtukudzi has died. He passed away in Harare today. He was 66 years old. Known around the world as Tuku, the prolific singer-songwriter released 67 albums over his lifetime. He started his musical career more than 40 years ago. Heather Maxwell, host of VOA's Music Time Africa, says his acoustic guitar style was unique and beautiful. Mtukudzi, she says, sang a lifetime of stories chronicling the lives of everyday people in Zimbabwe. His music became known simply as Tuku Music. His last album was called Hanyaga, or Concern. Tuku was one of Africa's most well-known musicians. Mtukudzi was one of the most recognized voices to emerge from Zimbabwe's musical scene. He toured around the world singing in Shona, Ndebele, and English. A boat made entirely of plastic waste collected from Kenya's beaches will start its maiden voyage today to raise awareness about the tons of plastic being dumped in the Indian Ocean every year. The boat will sail from Lamu in Kenya to the Tanzanian island of Zanzibar, a 500-kilometer expedition. The crew will make stopovers at coastal villages and towns to engage with communities about the threat of plastic waste to our oceans. From Nairobi, Ruben Chama reports.
Dubbed Flip Floppy, the first of its kind boat is made from 10 tons of discarded plastic. It has been built by a team calling for a plastic revolution to stem the flow of up to 12 million tons of plastic waste dumped into the world's ocean every year. Some of it merges into massive islands of debris. Dipesh Pabari is the co-founder of the project.
It's a small dab. It's only 9 meters long. Tried and tested on the water around Lamu for the past 4 to 5 months. We launched the boat September 2018 on World Ocean Day. In terms of safety, the boat is equipped with life jackets, VHF radio. We actually have a company that is assisting us in terms of global risk management on the ocean. We have an accompanying dhow that is 12 meters long that has already sailed to Zanzibar and will be accompanying us on it.
The sailing boat is expected to arrive in Zanzibar's Stone Town on February the 7th.
We'll be stopping along route, intending to stop in Watamu, Kilifi, Mombasa, Diani and Shimoni before we make our way across the ocean into Tanzanian waters with the blessings of the Tanzanian authorities. It's not a new route. It's a route that has been plowed for the past 2,000 years, if not longer, by dhows trading alongside. We will also be hosting various talks, we'll be showing films. The idea is to pass on a positive message, a message of hope, a message of change.
In Africa, marine debris represents a potential threat to food security and economic development. With over 12 million people on the continent engaged in fisheries, their livelihood is directly affected by marine pollution. Joyce Msuya is the acting executive director at the Nairobi-based United Nations Environment.
Let's look at the facts. Why plastics? We are drowning in plastics. We recycle barely 9% of the plastic we use. Sub-Saharan Africa generates 170 million tons of waste annually, 12% of which is plastic, 12% of 170 million tons of waste. We just cannot afford to continue with business as usual.
The expedition comes a month before the United Nations Environment Assembly, the world's highest level decision-making body on the environment, meets in Nairobi. More than 150 environment ministers from around the world are expected to attend. Coletta Anita Mkulwana, South African High Commissioner to Kenya, representing the Africa Diplomatic Corps, says education is key to tackling the problem.
As we celebrate this innovative solution from our home ground, it is important that we deal with some of these challenges. Within no time in our oceans, we might have more plastic than fish itself. How do we respond to these challenges? We need to make sure that we don't leave people behind.
The Dow has partnered with the UN Environment's Clean Seas Campaign, which engages government, the public, and the private sector in the fight against marine plastic pollution. Ruben Chama, VOA News, Nairobi.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wahib in Washington.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, Some Africans have concerns that Western versions of democracy are being imposed on the continent. Are democratic governments what's best for Africa? We'll discuss the issue on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.